This week on the Best of Flashpoints, BBC investigative journalist Greg Palace talks about the BP oil disaster. Shrimper and local activist Kendra Arneson in Louisiana talks about the oil slicks now reaching the wetlands on the Gulf Coast. Also, we remember radical environmental activist Judy Berry on the 20th anniversary of the FBI's bombing of her car in Oakland. And Davey D of Hard Knock Radio talks about a national epidemic of police brutality, arrests, and killings of young girls by law enforcement. All this straight ahead on this week's Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
We're now joined by Greg Palast. Greg Palast, BBC reporter, author of the bestseller, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, involved investigating financial stories. And, Greg, you're no stranger to oil spills. You were heavily involved in what was happening after the Exxon Valdez. Your initial response to all of this?
Well, I've seen this movie before. And before I was investigative reporter, I was investigator, and I was in charge of the investigation of fraud and racketeering charges in the grounding of the Exxon Valdez, working for the people that own the shore, the Chugach natives. And after 3 years of investigation in Alaska, I found that despite the name on the boat, which is Exxon's, that the real culprit in Alaska, the real number one party responsible for sliming the coast, was British Petroleum. And that's just a story that just never really been covered, because British Petroleum, unlike in the Gulf, didn't put their name on their Operation Alaska. They call it Alyeska, where they are head of the consortium group. They were in charge. British Petroleum was actually in charge of preventing, controlling, containing, and cleaning up an oil spill. And they are completely responsible. They did it. They were all, unlike the Gulf, they actually had a tremendous, an excellent plan for containing an oil spill, cleaning it up. You shouldn't have even read about the Exxon Valdez in the papers. But they decided to take a shortcut because their plan was a complete, absolute fabrication and lie. And I can give, for example, a couple quick examples. The Exxon Valdez hit on Bly Reef. British Petroleum had promised that it would have all the oil spill containment equipment right on Bly Island. Literally where the ship hit was supposed to be where the emergency equipment was. I said, supposed to be. Now, I understand there's no rocket science in containing an oil spill. You put a bunch of rubbers around it. A rubber skirt called boom. And if you surround the ship and then you bring in ships which suck the oil out that's within that circle of rubber called skimmers, and that's it. You can throw some dispersants. But British Petroleum had lied. They never put out the equipment because they figured who's gonna go out to the middle of Prince William Sound among the icebergs and the seals and the natives and check if there's a couple million bucks worth of equipment out on the ice. And the answer is they figured no one would do that. No one would care. The ship literally hit where the emergency equipment was supposed to be. The second thing is they, in order to get the emergency equipment out, the rubber skirts out, you need an emergency crew. Just like a fire department. You're not supposed to, you can't have a fireworks display on 4th of July without the fire engines out, as you know. You can't run ships without the spill response teams. You can't run oil rigs without the spill response teams. Well, we saw in the Gulf, where are the spill response teams? Okay, is number one. But I can tell you, in the case of Alaska, they had promised. They had literally hired the natives, the Chugach natives, because they're out there, trained them to grab the rubber equipment. They had helicopters and everything, and they trained these guys to actually jump at the freezing water with the rubber and set it all out and contain any spill. They could have quickly put out the rubber skirts around that, the Exxon Valdez, and basically stop the oil from going anywhere. And in fact, here's the ill-making thing. The natives were watching the boat hit the reef. They saw this tanker coming closer and closer to Bly Reef, which is right outside the Tetitlik village. And the Tetitlik natives went outside their house, went to their beach, and they're saying it was midnight, and they were thinking, what are they doing? What are they, you know, this is some type of weird, you know, safety experiment or something. They're running the ship right towards our village. They were a bit concerned. Then, bang, the shit hit the reef. They could have literally gone out if they had the equipment, but they'd been fired. All the natives had been fired by British Petroleum to save money. And they didn't tell this to the state or federal government. They said that there still was a spill response team. And when they said, well, where's the natives? Said, oh, don't worry. We've got other guys. And they simply listed a bunch of their employees who had no training, who had no idea what to do. It's like saying, you know, Greg Palast and Dennis Bernstein are now your fire department. And then when a building starts burning, they say, well, we've never handled a hose. You don't know where is the stuff, you know? You know, this is what British Petroleum did. And here's the thing. They learned the lesson of the Exxon Valdez, which was they got away with it. Exxon has the lowest estimate of damage, obviously, in the Exxon breakup, which is $3 billion. British Petroleum paid $125 million, 100% of it covered by there's a national oil spill fund. And so British Petroleum itself, out of its own treasury, paid not one dime, not one pound to anyone for the Exxon Valdez spill, for which they had the major responsibility. And what they learned is that if they cheap out and they lie, that they can save billions and billions. I mean, you're talking internationally, you're talking billions. Last year, British Petroleum, Tony Hayward, its CEO, cut billions off their production budget and surprised everyone, pumped up his stock by saying, we've cut an extra $1 billion a year off our production costs, despite the fact that our production is rising, and it's rising in the most difficult, dangerous places like Deepwater Gulf. How do you cut $1 billion a year off increased production in the most dangerous areas? The answer is, because they obviously didn't stop the drilling's up. They cut the safety budgets. That's what they did. They cut the safety and environmental budgets, and that's where they saved. And believe me, they're going to save here, too. It's a profit center. They're not going to lose a dime, all things considered. Take my word for it.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, that's the voice of Greg Palast, where we've been talking about the massive and expanding oil spill. I love what the head of BP said, nothing to worry about. It's a big ocean, Greg. It's like a spit in the ocean.
Yeah, I know. It's a big ocean, but it's one of my favorite ones.
yeah.
How many do we have? You know, we start using them up real quick. This is definitely, you know, the thing that BP does. And I got to tell you right now, same thing, you know. And you know, for example, if the U.S. Navy, once Obama decided to shuffle onto the scene, just like Haiti where he waited five days to nationalize the spill response. When that happened, the Navy was suddenly able to find contractors with 12 miles of rubber skirting, rubber boom, and 7 skimmers. The Navy called up and got the equipment. Why did it take the U.S. military to find rubber for British Petroleum? Okay, and if British Petroleum had simply made those calls on the first night, which they didn't want to do, they didn't want to spend the money. Okay, they thought they could just cut this thing off and not even get the stuff out there in case. If they had 12 miles of boom, if you survive No Child's Behind Left education program and do your, you know, no pi divided, you know, the circumference of 12 divided by pi, et cetera, you know, you got about a mile and a half in each direction from the well. You can make a big circle of rubber. You put out those 7 skimmers, and this would have been, you know, last month's event. But instead, Obama waited 5 days, which is, by the way, inexcusable. I'm sorry. You know, and again, what you heard is this constant reliance on BP.
Well, did you hear one of the scientists accidentally referred to the BPA?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, this is the problem. They're still relying on BP. On one hand, they're saying they're completely irresponsible. On the other hand, they're relying on them. And by the way, I will say one thing we missed. You know, Obama's giving big speech. BP, British Petroleum, is going to pay for everything here. And then, as it was pointed out to him, there is a $75 million liability limit written into the law.
That's convenient.
And so when BP said, well, we'll pay all legitimate claims, suddenly the White House said, we assume you mean by that that you're not sticking to the $75 million limit, which, you know, was blown away within 48 hours, right? And BP's been quite silent about that. And I can tell you, I negotiated with Exxon. Exxon made the same speech after the Exxon Valdez. They said, we're going to pay for everything. Of course, BP was hiding because their name wasn't on the ship. But Exxon said, we'll pay for everything. 20 years later, the Supreme Court was still hearing the Exxon case 20 years later.
And a lot of people were dead.
Yeah, my clients. I mean, I can tell you, Paul Komkoff, one of my good friends, a seal hunter, who is waiting to get a boat back. Okay, he's waiting to get a boat. And he, you know, by the time it came in last year, his money, and he's been dead for 4 years. You know, this is, and you're going to get the same jive from BP. We'll take care of everything. And yeah, they're not going to be able to get away with $75 million, but I can tell you, they've saved an awful lot. Plus, the price of oil has gone up because of the Gulf spill. They estimate, say, about $2.50 a barrel. They sell $4 million a day. So they are making, think about this, they're making $10 million a day, right? They're talking about the $7 million a day that they're spending. They're making $10 million a day on their sales because of the Gulf spill. Don't forget that other side of the effect. So, you know, they're not, you know, they're going to have to pay some bucks. But believe me, what they've saved over the years on equipment and what they're going to save ultimately by resisting, it's worth it. It's a permit to spill, a cheap permit to spill.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. The devastation of the Gulf of Mexico and the Gulf shoreline struck home today. Thousands of thick, toxic, gooey, rust-colored gallons of oil washed up into the delicate marshes of Louisiana and the coastline, throwing into jeopardy the entire ecosystem of the region. Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal told reporters after a boat tour to the southernmost point of the Mississippi River estuary that we have what is happening is what we have all been fearing. Jindal said, this wasn't tar balls, this wasn't sheen, this is heavy oil in our wetlands. Meanwhile, independent scientists repeated their claim that BP and the U.S. government have been continually downplaying the extent of the spill. I mean, the huge size of it, which scientists now say, as I said, is equivalent of the Exxon Valdez spill oil spill every 3 days. It is a terrible time for the people down there. We're going to go to Venice, Louisiana now, and we're joined again by a shrimper, a mom, now an activist, Kendra Arnson, who is heartbroken and has now has her whole life, her whole lifestyle in jeopardy. Kendra, welcome back. Remind people exactly where you are.
Thank you, Dennis. How are you doing? I'm doing okay down here, trying not to lose my mind. We are at the southernmost point of the residential area of southeast Louisiana. We are literally about 15 miles north of the mouth of the Mississippi. I am the last resident on Highway 23 with children to live in this area.
The last resident with children to live in the area.
Yes, I'm at the furthest southern part that you can get to in our area. It's as far south as you can go, as far as on land goes here where the residential area is. Right across the levee from me, about, I would say, 300 yards from the levee is where my home sits. And right across the levee is where you see all these boats getting ready to go out all over the television and our Coast Guard station and where the efforts are based. You know, the oil's further out. But at any rate, it did hit home today. Actually, yesterday, whenever I got the wire over the phone from a news fella down here in Venice telling me that the oil had penetrated the marshes and it wasn't being reported. And I got on the phone with several different people and just started blowing a horn as loud as I could to say, hey, somebody's got to get out here and get some coverage on this. My biggest problem with this is it's not being cleaned up. You know, like you said, Exxon Valdez spill every 3 days. Basically, what that means is I've done the math, and we're looking at what they're admitting at this point anywhere between 90 to over 100 million gallons. Now, we're at day 30 or right around there. I've lost track of time here with all this craziness going on, but over between 90 and over 100 million gallons of oil that's already spilled out. Now, BP has a website, and I've studied their website, and I went on there just yesterday. And at that point, they said at 6.6 million gallons of oily substance, so that means water and oil, has been skimmed up off the surface. Now, I don't know how much they've burned, but if that's the case, what have they been doing? What is the problem? We have boats. Our harbors are full of boats. Our men are not working. We have the manpower. There's absolutely no excuse for this. The federal government should have stepped in from day one and then bill BP, another botched job. I feel like the Obama administration, and I hate to say this out loud because I might have repercussions and consequences, but this is how I feel, and it's the bottom line. The Obama administration has not taken any responsibility for these people that are from with British Petroleum drilling out here in our Gulf. They should have stepped up to the plate to begin with, but I think that they're scared that they, too, will botch the job, and then he's not going to be in the seat that he wants to be in for the next several years.
Describe us, help us understand the gravity of the loss just at the physical level first. When we say marshes, the oil, the thick, heavy, gooey, rust-colored oil. By the way, they're saying something like 3 million gallons a day. It's incomprehensible, but tell us about the actual the marsh and what's being destroyed.
The marsh is our nurseries. It's the nurseries for a lot of the fish throughout the entire Gulf. Our deep water fish, some of them come in and lay in these shallow water areas. Now, what you have is you have the Gulf of Mexico, a strip of land in between that runs down into it, and the river cuts right through the middle of Plaquemines Parish. There's a levee on each side of the Gulf and the river on both sides, the east and the west bank on the property. At any rate, further down south and all up the parish, the whole entire parish is one peninsula. It's an 80-mile strip that sticks out in the middle of the Gulf. And all the way up the parish between the Gulf and the land is our marshlands. And this isn't like a small little pond. These are huge, huge areas, miles upon, I mean, I don't even know how many square miles, I guess I'd have to check into that we actually have of marshlands in this part of Louisiana. And it's just devastating. I mean, how can they only have two birds? You know, the wildlife, the sea life, the strain on the humans here, not to mention the possible health that's at risk due to our workers not having proper safety equipment like respirators and gloves and boots. Now, when we did the meetings and all, that was all supposed to be provided. That hasn't been provided for most of our workers out here that are working, whether they're commercial fishermen, work in the sports industry, or they're working for the oil mop companies. A lot of these guys aren't even wearing respirators. That's a big, big red flag. I mean, look at the track record with BP and all the safety violations that have come up, and Mineral Management Service and the state and federal government didn't step in to do something before we lost these 11 men out here from this explosion. And I think that, you know, I think it's criminal negligence. I really do. I really think, and I think Boxer had a point when she went ahead and went through with saying it publicly, that it needs to be investigated. And everybody says, oh, no, 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 wait a minute, let us finish our report. Your reports are neither here nor there. Criminal negligence has been going on. 96 or 98 violations by British Petroleum? I mean, what is the excuse for this? I'm lost in all this. It's crazy.
As I said, we'll devote most of today's show to the life and times of radical environmentalist wobbly organizer Judy Berry. Anybody who met or worked with Judy Berry understood that she was a unique spirit devoted to the betterment of the lives of all people. As a wobbly organizer, she took on the hardest tasks and was effective even as a woman at a time when they were not welcome in the union leadership positions and as organizers all that much. After her work as a wobbly, she co-founded the radical environmental group Earth First and transformed the way people think about both the environment and how to protect it. 20 years ago, on May 24th, 1990, around noon, she became the victim of domestic terrorism. Someone, maybe the police, maybe corporate interests behind the logging industry, maybe federal agents, put a bomb under the seat of her old Subaru. As it traveled through Oakland in the afternoon, even as hundreds of students were out behind Oakland High School, the bomb nearly killed Judy and wounded her partner in the planning of Redwood Summer. That would be an environmental action modeled after the civil rights actions of the 1960s. That was Daryl Cherney with her. Judy Berry and Daryl Cherney were arrested on the scene by Oakland police and blamed for the bombing themselves. Judy was still unconscious when she was arrested. Many people had many reasons to kill Judy Berry, and there had been a number of attempts against her life and her family leading up to Redwood Summer. Ultimately, with the help of her friends, you know, I knew I couldn't get through this, Alicia. We should just jump into this. Why don't you just tell us a little bit about how you would explain to this audience who Judy Berry was and what she meant to you and the people around
her? Well, first of all, Dennis, thanks for having us on the air today. It's really wonderful to come together and remember her work, and especially the historic year 1990, Redwood Summer, and the car bombing. Judy Berry was an Earth First organizer. She was a feminist. She was a union organizer. She I met her about a year after the bombing, when she was already severely disabled, but still working on the front lines and organizing to defend the ancient redwoods in Northern California. She was a single mother. She was a working woman and a longtime radical activist, and always somebody who believed in taking action, not just talking about it, not just theorizing about it, but getting our bodies out and taking nonviolent direct action to protect the trees. The other thing that she was so remarkable for, and what really had a huge effect on our community in the North Coast, Humboldt and Mendocino counties in particular, north of here, where the redwoods are, is that she believed that the destruction of the environment was a social change issue, and that she used social organizing tactics to defend the environment, which included class struggle. She built alliances with the timber workers in the region. A lot of times we would be out in the woods and we would be confronting loggers, mill workers, truckers, and Judy actually worked on the eve of Redwood Summer and the years preceding Redwood Summer to build an alliance to oppose the big timber corporations that involved currently employed timber workers in the industry. And a lot of us believe that that's probably what made her such a threat and such a target for repression and violence as what happened on May 24th, 1990. The other thing that she also did was she believed in movement building and mass movement building to protect the trees. So along with the timber worker alliance, she also called for mass nonviolent protests, which involved bringing ultimately thousands of people to the North Coast to break the stranglehold that the timber industry had on power in our region and bring the eyes of the nation to the area to slow and stop the cut.
That's the voice of Alicia Littletree, and we're going to talk more with her about what it was like to be with Judy as she prepared to sue the Oakland police and the FBI and created this document, this big book, heavy enough to hold back a stadium door. I want to bring into the conversation, oh, there you are, Karen Pickett, and I want to come back to the explosion and maybe give a little context of what was going on and why there was a lot of tension and reason for Judy and Daryl to fear.
Well, I'm also really glad that you're doing this show and dedicating this time, Dennis, because it's, you know, it's important to look back, it's important to remember, but it's important to put what happened 20 years ago and that kind of movement building and that kind of attack by the FBI and by the corporations into today's context, because there's a lot to be learned from it as we move forward. And I started working with Judy a couple years before the bombing, and I kind of watched the vision of Redwood Summer take shape. And Judy was the principal architect of Redwood Summer. A lot of other people ended up working on it, and Daryl and other people on the North Coast were there in the beginning, as well as myself, but it was really Judy's brainchild. And we had a meeting the night before the bombing at the Seeds of Peace house in Oakland, and Utah Phillips was there, and a lot of people were there planning for, we kind of mapped out the big actions of Redwood Summer. And then the following day, Judy and Daryl were headed down to UC Santa Cruz, because we were doing a lot of organizing on the college campuses, not just in California, but across the country. And they were going down there to play music and to talk about the Redwoods and to get people excited about Redwood Summer. So it was the following day that the bomb exploded in Judy's car, and just as they were pulling out of Oakland to head down to Santa Cruz. And I actually got a call. I was at work, and I got a call from my roommate because someone had called the Mendocino Environmental Center, who had called my house. And I dashed out of work and went to Highland Hospital, where they had been taken. And this was just after noon. The bomb exploded just a few minutes before noon. And I was the first person at the hospital. And in the next few hours, hundreds of people just started converging as people heard about this. But initially, I was there by myself, and I was trying to find out how badly Judy was injured. Her injuries were life-threatening, and Daryl was injured as well, but Judy was undergoing emergency surgery. And one of the things that was interesting that happened when I first got to the hospital was that the FBI said that they wanted to ask me a few questions, and they took me downstairs. And at first that seemed kind of reasonable. You know, I was so horrified by what had happened, and I thought, well, okay, you know, a bomb explodes and you don't know why and you don't know who put it there. This is what the police agencies are supposed to be doing. They're supposed to be asking questions. And so I told them that this seemed like the culmination of what had been going on. It was far worse than we ever thought it would be. But Judy had been receiving threats for months.
She was run off the road?
She was run off the road. She was rear-ended by a logging truck, and her kids were in the car, and her friends' kids were in the car. And so the threats were real. And just very shortly before the bombing, an image of her face, a picture of her with the crosshairs of a rifle scope superimposed on her face, was posted on the door of the Mendocino Environmental Center. And actually, the picture was from when she went to a Mendocino County Board of Supervisors meeting to call for the eminent domain seizure of Louisiana Pacific's land. And so those, you know, those were the kinds of ideas that Judy was coming up with, and that was the kind of organizing that she was doing, and she was making a lot of waves. And people knew that a lot of people were going to be coming to the Redwood region for the summer of civil disobedience. And so things were getting very heated on the North Coast, but they were, you know, it wasn't just in a continuum, they were escalating. And so that's why I thought, okay, this is what it has led to. And I told the FBI that, because I figured, you know, they're working down here with the Oakland police. They probably didn't know what was happening up on the North Coast. But they, frankly, they didn't seem that interested in what I was telling them. And they started asking me personal questions. And so we had no idea what had happened or, you know, who had done this. But, you know, within an hour of the bombing, even though we knew so little, I knew that something was very, very fishy.
And it got worse from there in terms of the campaign against her in the media, and in many circles.
Yes, it got a lot worse very quickly. Actually, right after that, I was as the crowds were converging, I was taken to the Oakland police station and held for hours. And at the same time that Judy was undergoing surgery and Judy and Daryl were being arrested, and within a couple days, the FBI and the Oakland police held a press conference and said that they were filing charges. We already knew that they were arrested and that they were filing these charges of possession and transport of explosives. And this was without looking any other place. And this is, you know, not only based on ludicrous facts, because they knew that the bomb was directly under her driver's seat and it was triggered by a motion device. And why would someone do that, even if they were a bomber? But also, Judy and Daryl and Earth First had an unbroken record of nonviolence. You know, there was no information to feed into those conclusions. But they did charge, they not only charged them with possession of explosives, but they announced that the bomb was in the back seat to support their allegations, when their own police photos, which we didn't have access to yet, showed this giant gaping hole right underneath Judy's driver's seat.
All right, let me come in here because we want to hear a little bit of Judy's voice. And there is a CD later on in this broadcast. Those of you who want to help this kind of reporting and the kind of story that we're covering here and support Flashpoints the way Judy did, we'll tell you how to do that. But this is, I think it's called Who Killed Judy Barry is the name. Who Bombed Judy Barry. By the way, Judy won the case with the help of great lawyers. We're going to talk to them in one moment, and Alicia working very hard, and everybody else. What am I saying? Oh, let's listen to Judy.
This is the largest forest rally in the history of the U.S. Forest Protection Movement. And it's about to be the largest civil disobedience arrest in one arrest. And this is not symbolic because, you know, the system does not respond. The system does not respond to us when we politely ask them. But we learned last year as we were walking over that line that they hear us when we take that kind of action. Our struggle to save these forests has been a trail of tears, as Mika Wawona said the other day. It has been a trail of tears and broken trees. Everything that we have done everything in our power. We've worked through their system. We've changed their laws. We've put, quote unquote, the best forestry laws in the country on the books. We've done everything we can to enforce them, and they still take every tree in the forest. So that's why we're going to make this statement in the only way that they seem to be able to hear. And this statement is not just being made for Headwaters. We're here for Headwaters because Headwaters is endangered today, and Headwaters is the last best thing left. But this is not just for Headwaters. This is for all of the trees that we've been fighting so hard to save for all these years. This is for Albion, Enchanted Meadow. This is for Osprey Grove. This is for China Left. This is for Sugarloaf. This is for Enola Hill, Calico Canyon, Rocky Brook, and Olympic Peninsula. This is for Cold Ballard. This is for Mount Graham and Shawnee and Brighton Bush and Millennium Grove and all of the trees that they have taken despite every effort that we've given. Where you live or whatever issue you work on, because this is all one issue. This is all one system, that same corrupt system that rewards Charles Hurwitz while they take welfare checks away from needy mothers. That's what we're here to protest. We're here to stop the destruction of the earth. We're making our stand. So we're going to start taking our stroll down Fisher Road, and we'll see you down at that gate. Let's get out there. Watch out, Charles Hurwitz. We're coming, and you can't stop us.
anybody, if you forgot for a moment who Judy Barry was, that's who Judy Barry is.
And we proceeded to cross the Pacific Lumber property line 1,033 people crossed that property line in an act of civil disobedience. It lasted late into the night. I think at 3 a.m. the sheriffs ran out of arrest forms and plastic handcuffs, and still people were crossing the line. So,
We forgot to mention that Judy is a wonderful fiddle player and singer, and that song was at the core of it all, kept the spirit high.
Yes.
Say that. You have a song?
I do have a song. How did you know?
Is there one that we can...
I was just feeling
This is Alicia.
Oh, this is Alicia again. Today I was remembering probably my favorite song that Judy ever taught me. It's by Holly Near. It's called Mountain Song, and this is for the activists of Mountain Summer. I have dreamed on this mountain since first I was my mother's daughter, and you can't just take my dreams away. Not with me watching. You may drive a big machine, but I was born a big strong woman, and you can't just take my dreams away. Well, this old mountain raised my many daughters. Some died young, some are still living. If you're coming here for to take this mountain, well, we ain't come here to give it. I have dreamed on this mountain since first I was my mother's daughter, and you can't just take my dreams away. Not with me watching. You may drive a big machine, but I was born a big strong woman, and you can't just take my dreams away. Without me fighting, no, you can't just take my dreams away.
Alicia Littletree, this is the 20th anniversary of the bombing of Judy Berry. They can never kill the spirit that she gave to us, that inspires us. I want to let people know that if you want to celebrate together, you can meet the people in the studio. Alicia Littletree, Daryl Cherney will be there. Many people, Dennis Cunningham, an attorney on the case. You're going to hear more from Alicia Music, Gary Ball, and others. There's a tribute film to Judy. Lots going on, and it is happening on Sunday the 23rd, 7 p.m. For those of you in the Bay Area, it's La Peña Cultural Center. This is a wonderful place with a wonderful history to celebrate Judy Berry, and she did mean a great deal to all of us. I want to turn the discussion a little bit to, before you leave the mic, Alicia, I want to we're going to focus on the case, and we're going to talk to the lawyers, but I want to just talk to you a little bit about what was happening, because you were taking care of Judy leading up to the case, and in the last months of her life, when she was, I guess you could say, living so that she could live posthumously in the courtroom and help to win this extraordinary case against the FBI and the Oakland police. Talk about that.
Well, we did hear her speak at the September 15th rally in Humboldt County, the Headwaters rally. That was in 1996. She was already sick with breast cancer at that point, but she just hadn't been diagnosed
yet. When we heard her speaking?
When we heard her speak. Yeah, she was diagnosed shortly after that with metastatic breast cancer. It was very aggressive cancer, and she did not have very long after she was diagnosed. But she spent those months getting her case ready for us to take to trial. She was very clear that this case was not about her, wasn't about Earth First, but it was about the right of every activist to organize for social change in this country. And she wanted it to go forward. So just 4 weeks before she died, Dennis Cunningham and Judy and the Oakland and FBI lawyers took Judy's deposition. over 2 days in Ukiah. She was lying on a couch for it.
A lot of pain.
She was always in pain after the bombing, but she was very sick, and she told her story. And actually, that was one of the most powerful days of the trial in Oakland for me, was when Judy finally got the chance to tell her story for herself in front of a jury.
And win the case posthumously.
And won it. Judy Berry versus the United States of America. Yeah, so it was. It was a very, very top priority for her to make sure that that case would live on after her death.
Well, before we bring in Dennis and Ben, we're going to do that. You know, as a young woman, what kind of influence, what did it mean to be around somebody like Judy Berry?
Oh, God. I met Judy when I was 17 years old, and she recognized something in me and was my mentor from almost the second that I met her. We were practically inseparable as friends and organizing partners. And I wouldn't be the same person without her. I mean, first of all, she encouraged me to play music and to learn the guitar and to perform. She always encouraged me to take leadership position within the organizing of Earth First. She taught me how to do radio. And in fact, I inherited her radio show in Mendocino County.
What
community.
Was that called?
It was called, when she did it, it was Punch and Judy. When I did it, it was Truth to Power. But anyway, she just was an incredible mentor and friend and comrade. And I mean, of course, she inspired me with her commitment, her intelligence, her passion, her joy, her spirit. There was no way I wasn't going to do everything I could after her death to make sure that case came to trial. And I know that the whole team felt that way.
Well, here's what we're going to do, everybody. I'm going to surprise the engineers and everybody over there in that other room. What we're going to do is we're going to stay with the affiliates, and we're going to go to the sound from my interview. We're going to listen to a little bit of an interview that I did right after Judy got out of the hospital. We ended up in a car. You might be able to hear outside the window of the car her daughter knocking. I guess she was a little worried that Judy was in a car again doing an interview, but it was the quietest place we could find, of course, at a rally. So let's listen to a little bit of that. We're going to have a little changing of people at the microphones. We're going to talk to the lawyers, and we're going to keep talking about Judy Berry and remembering, and you can remember her with us today. And you can remember her on Sunday, 7 p.m., La Peña. For those of you in the Bay Area, La Peña, 3105 Shattuck Avenue. And the work obviously continues. Stay with us. Listen to Judy Berry. This is Dennis Berenstein, and I am sitting in a car, of all places, with Judy Berry. And almost a year to the day, Judy, well, it's coming up, the anniversary of the bombing in which you and Daryl Cherney almost lost your lives. And I want to start there by asking you, first of all, how you're feeling or have you recovered yet?
Well, I haven't recovered yet, and I never will recover. I received permanent injuries from it. I've gotten farther than anyone expected me to. I was not expected to walk, and I can walk short distances without assistance. It's hard to sit. It's you know, I have low endurance. I'm not up to what I used to be, but I'm living back where I was, back in the Redwood region, and I'm still in the movement, and I'm as much as I can by my energy levels, I'm still active.
All right, let me ask you. First, for people who don't understand what happened, could you describe exactly what happened and who you think might be responsible?
Okay, well, immediately preceding this bombing, I need to put it in a little bit of context. We have a real crisis in the Redwoods in that a few giant corporations are cutting them down as fast as they can, and they're almost gone. 95% have been cut, and we feel we have a crisis to stop them, an ecological crisis and an economic crisis, because as they finish cutting, they leave our already poor rural communities decimated with people, just like the Rust Belt or the Dust Bowl. People have nothing else to do for a living. So in this context, Earth First came on the scene several years ago and began to use direct action, innovative kind of tactics to fight the corporations and bring attention to the cutting of the redwoods. For example, we will climb a old growth redwood tree and set up a platform 100 feet up in the air and have somebody sit in that platform to prevent the tree from being cut. So that kind of theatrical demonstration to bring attention to, that was the method by which we were working. But the more effective that we got, the more forceful they seemed to get on the other side. And things seemed to be reaching a fever pitch here. There was an initiative coming up in the fall, that, as of last summer, 1990, there was to be an initiative where the voters would get to vote on reforming logging rules to make them slow down. And because of this, the timber companies had decided they were going to take out every tree they could as fast as they could last summer to beat the regulations. And when they announced this, we announced that we were sponsoring a campaign called Redwood Summer, and that basing our actions on that, we also called it Mississippi Summer in the California Redwoods, and we modeled it on the Freedom Summers of Mississippi. We said we needed freedom riders for the forest to come and engage in nonviolent actions and try to slow this cut down. And we appealed to people all over the country in order to get the word out, and also because along with the level of cutting, the level of violence against demonstrators was rising in our area. A woman had been punched and had her nose broken. One of our organizers had been knocked out at a demonstration, and I and my children had been run off the road by a logging truck on the way to a demonstration, and sent to the hospital by it. And there were many other incidences like this. So we felt that in order to be able to continue to demonstrate, the local police were turning their backs on the situation, and we needed to have the eyes of the nation on us. We didn't think that people would approve either of the slaughtering of redwoods or the slaughtering of demonstrators. So we put out a national call for action, and when we did it, tensions rose even more. And I began to receive a series of death threats that were increasingly frightening. The most scary one was a photo of me from the newspaper with a rifle scope and crosshair superimposed over my face and a yellow ribbon, which is the symbol of the timber industry, stapled to it. And it became really clear that I and other organizers were being specifically targeted, and they were attempting to terrorize us. But we continued, and we didn't back down, and we continued to put out this call. And as we went out, Daryl Cherney, myself, and some other Earth Firsters, we began a tour of the California colleges to do a little show to get students to come to Redwood Summer. And on the way to one of those shows, my car blew up with me in it, and I was nearly killed by a pipe bomb that was placed under my seat. And, it went off without warning. It was hidden way under my seat, so I couldn't possibly have seen it or anything. But in addition to being literally nearly killed by it, I was also blamed for it. After the bomb went off, the police came in, and rather than, as I suspected they would, well, I was unconscious at the time, but, rather than looking for a culprit among the people who had been ostentatiously threatening me and bringing about this reign of terror up in our rural areas, they said that Daryl and I were not only suspects in the bombing, but were the only suspects.
Wanted to ask Davey D to come back into the studio after Hard Knock Radio because, you know, we were getting into this, Davey, yesterday with the 7-year-old who gets bombed and then shot through the head on her own couch, and her father's arrested in his kid's blood. And it was the wrong apartment in front of cameras for a big show. And then you said, hey, Dennis, you know, this we're not alone here. You pointed out to me, among other things, a 5-year-old getting arrested in kindergarten.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a 5-year-old in Florida who had a temper tantrum. They brought in
kindergarten,
and right out of Tampa Bay, they brought in 3 police officers to hold her down and arrest her. That was pretty tragic. And Pittsburgh
handcuffed her.
Yes, 5 years old.
Because the kindergarten teacher couldn't handle it.
Yeah, and the kindergarten teacher was on the news saying, "Well, you know, sometimes kids get out of hand," and you're just sitting there like, "Wow, she actually justifying this." In Pittsburgh, there was a well-known case with a woman named Pamela Lawton. She was on her way to a football game with Pee Wee League. She had a 7-year-old and her 8-year-old in the back of the car. Cop pulls her over for a traffic violation, comes over, has his gun drawn before he even gets to the car, goes to the passenger side, and tells the mom to put her hands outside the window and all this other stuff. The kids start crying. the cop points his 9mm at the 7-year-old.
Seven-year-old.
Tell her if she doesn't stop crying, he'll shoot her. Of course, the mom loses, you know, it's like, what are you doing? What's going on? Other cops arrive on the scene and order this officer. His name is Takoski or something like that. Japanese name. I'll remember that in a minute. But orders him to put the gun down. And then they went to search the car. Said there was a weapon there. There was no weapon. And so then they charged the mom with disorderly conduct and would not let this charge drop. Disorderly conduct because she's yelling and having a fit because you put a gun in the face of her 7-year-old. So the charges dragged through court for a year. Some of the people, we covered it on Hard Knock, the folks from One Hood out of Pittsburgh, they helped with the sister, and finally the charges were dropped. But this was an awful thing. The other thing that you have is just recent. This is in Chicago. 13-year-old found a pair of glasses, her teacher's glasses, went looking for her, couldn't find her, said, let me hold on to them. She's an honor student.
Went
to class. Somebody said she had the glasses. The teacher comes in there with the principal, accused the young lady, 13 years old, of stealing the glasses. She's trying to explain that, you know, I just was holding them until I could get to the office. To make a long story short, she was suspended and arrested.
Suspended and arrested, right.
Then they reversed the suspension. They weren't going to press charges, but by then, the newspapers got a hold of it. So then the teacher came back and said, well, the hell with it. I'm going to press charges on her anyway. So here's a woman that's trying to go into the Army, has, you know, 13 years old, very focused, honest student, and this teacher is trying to ruin her life. So this just happened last week. And then the other thing, when I thought about it, it reminded me of Shaquanda Cotton down in Paris, Texas. You know, whose mom was an activist who was constantly railing against the inadequacies of the school district down there. Her daughter was constantly being targeted. Daughter had an altercation with a hall monitor, pushed her, and the judge gave her 7 years. And, 7 years. Yeah, she spent a year in jail, never had an arrest record. And I guess the point that I'm looking, that I was trying to paint is that, you know, this sort of situation, as tragic as it was, is not an unusual one when you look at all these array of cases where there's a disregard for black life, you know, life of poor people. And in this case, you know, you talk about the lives of young
and they really go after the kids.
Yeah.
You know, and nobody ever believes the kids when they, you know, let me tell you a story that I never told, Davey. I lost my first teaching job. I was sitting in a school in East New York in Brooklyn, a very difficult neighborhood, and I'm sitting there writing my lesson plans. I'm a young teacher. I'm 21 years old, and this maybe sixth grader comes flying in, rolling in, you know, scared, screaming, and this principal, assistant principal, starts to kick her.
Wow.
So I jump up, and I get in the way, and I say, you know, this is illegal. You're not going to be able to do this anymore here. Sorry. And then the girl who's just beyond herself starts screaming at the assistant principal, you know, you've been wearing the same pants for 3 months, you know, and, you know, you're ugly, whatever. So he starts writing things down, everything she says.
Right.
And then she's expelled. She's thrown out of school forever. I went to the principal's office. This was the assistant principal, to report this guy. The next morning, I was called into the principal's office, and I was given two options. One is, Mr. Bernstein, you've been teaching how long? 2 months? If you ever want to teach again, we're going to write you a nice recommendation, and you're going to get the hell out of here. If you don't, we're going to make sure you don't work, and you will. You can go out and do something else, but you're never going to teach.
Wow.
This is how I left.
Yeah, I mean, it's for a lot of people listening, they probably
Oh, by the way, I forgot to tell you, the principal and the assistant principal had been driving to school together for 20 years. They live next door to each other, and I kid you not, they share a lawnmower anyway.
Wow. You know, I think, you know, for a lot of people, they probably think it's, you know, no, this is just exaggerations. But it happens more and more. Just recently in Houston, Texas, people might have seen this on the news. They shown a teacher beating the daylights out of a fifth grader, you know, just wailing on him, punching him out. The whole nine, teacher, of course, fired and suspended. But, you know, it's just that I think...
It's condoned.
Yeah, in many ways, you know, and there's justification, and I can understand, and people will make all types of excuses. But it's not only unprofessional, it's horrific. You know, when you couple that along with the fact of what you have with these priests and the cover-up that goes on there,
absolutely.
Then you look and you say, wow, there's a lot of folks that just really don't like kids. We're not just talking about the people who did the acts, but all the people that support and make excuses, aren't upset and look at this as maybe that girl did something that she deserved to be arrested. Maybe the young lady Ayana did something that she deserved to be shot.
7-year-old.
And if you remember,
the
first stories that came out of Detroit was that, you know, that the assailant was in the house. People said the family must have been harboring a criminal. The grandma jumped on the cop. It was all types of things that came off, except you didn't hear that they had a film crew. You know, in tow, the film crew wanted some action, and it's just too boring to do regular police work and just maybe wait for the, you know, the person to come out since you had innocent people in the house. All that sort of stuff.
A&E film crew that was.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just to remind, this is a 7-year-old sleeping on a couch who was first bombed with one of the flash bombs through the window and then shot through the head. And her father is arrested lying in the blood of her dead daughter. And they're in the wrong place.
Yeah. So this is something that I think, you know, what I would leave people with is that we're going to have to really, first of all, take a step back and look at how we view life. You know, these incidents can't be things that we just sweep away. You can't talk about the death of Ayana in Detroit and say that goes on in the hood. If you think so, then we better ask ourselves what happened to the white kid that today got arrested 5 years old. I'm going to remember what state. We got to ask what happened to the white kid that was tased in Indiana for riding.
It's a state of terror is what it is.
So it's not just even in the hood, so to speak. This is going on with kids in general. And I think all of us have a responsibility to step it up and really start holding people accountable on all sorts of levels.
There is a tremendous abuse of police power in this country.
Yes.
And this needs to be restrained. It grew out of Patriot. It was expanded. The terror was expanded. The ability to profile was expanded.
And also the zero tolerance thing.
And the zero tolerance, the three strikes. All these things led up to this near police state. Davey, we're out of time here, but I really want to thank you for coming in, for calling our attention to this. And people should check out the YouTube of the 5-year-old, the screaming, troubled 5-year-old being attacked by cops, handcuffed, and taken out of a kindergarten. As the teacher was fairly substantial, large person.
Yeah.
Little kid. Large person. Anyway, Davey, thank you so much.
Thank you. We'll talk to you later.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and The Block Report contribute to this program. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.